In the Canadian justice system, animals' interests are rarely represented, but the lawyers at Animal Justice fight to give them a voice in court and the political system. This is the Paw and Order Podcast, and these are their stories.
Hello and welcome to another edition. This is episode 5 of Paw and Order. I'm Peter Sankoff and I'm here today with my co-host, Camille Lapchuk. What up, Camille?
Hey, Peter. How's it going?
It's going pretty well, Camille. I got to tell you, when we started this project, I have to say there were moments when we were talking to each other and I said, but Camille, are we going to have enough stuff to talk about every 2 weeks? Because, you know, what is there to talk about with animals and the law?
And as it turns out, Peter, we have so much stuff for this episode that we actually had to reschedule an episode that we previously thought about doing about dog breeding to just to focus on the recent developments in Canadian news on animals and the law.
It's pretty unbelievable. We literally did. We had to turn around this episode at least 3 times simply because so many things are going on in animal law. So I don't know about you, Camille, but I'm super excited about this episode. I think it's going to be a lot of fun. We have big developments in Canadian law involving animals, and that just doesn't happen every day.
No, it's true. It's really fascinating. There's a family law case that we're going to get into. There's a case about Lucy the elephant in Edmonton and some stuff about the Vancouver Aquarium, too.
And we're not letting Barbara Streisand off the hook. Don't you worry. We're going to get to Barbara and her cloned dog in due course. But let's start it off, Camille, with there has been a lot going on. It's been a busy 2 weeks in Paw and Order land. What you been up to?
Well, Peter, I spent last week mostly out of Ottawa. I was down in Windsor speaking at the law school there, and that was really cool, actually. It's my first time ever being in Windsor and the first time at the law school. And a couple things really impressed me. First of all, the students are just so keen. It's a small school, but they still have a very, very active animal law club. And big shout out to Namisha and the rest of the gang for inviting me. It was a really, really good time. So I talked about animal law. And Peter, the other amazing thing is that Windsor is developing the very first center for research into alternatives to animal methods of research. So it's this testing facility. They're devising alternatives to animal tests.
Yeah, it's an exciting little group. They had an opening workshop in October of this year that they invited me to participate in. It was a really interesting idea. They brought in experts from a range of different disciplines to talk about how they should focus work of the center going forward. And unfortunately, I had a Supreme Court case the next week and I was unable to attend. But I was very excited when I looked at the material and what that group is really trying to do.
Yeah, they're up to some amazing stuff. And shout out to Dr. Chandrasekara, who's the driving force behind that. She's a really cool woman who used to be an animal researcher herself and eventually realized she couldn't keep doing that. And now she's devoted to developing alternatives. So I think they're set to make some pretty big waves in Canada.
Fantastic. And I'm also aware of the fact that Windsor was one of the testing grounds for a new program that we are excited to get going at Animal Justice. Last show, we gave a shout out to the Animal Legal Defense Fund. And we talked about the fact that the Animal Legal Defense Fund really pioneered the idea of getting animal law going in law schools with their Student Animal Legal Defense Fund clubs. And there are what are called SALDIF clubs. That's the acronym, SALDIF. Across Canada. And we've been really grateful to the work that the Animal Legal Defense Fund has done, but I think it's time for, we think it's time for animal justice to stand on its own 2 feet.
Yeah, that's right. We've just received so many comments from students that they really want to see Canadian-focused research opportunities and ways to get more involved in our work. So we're working a bit with the ALDF, and we're developing a Canadian student club program right now. So if you are in a Canadian animal law club in a law school and you're listening, you can expect to get some stuff from us in the next few weeks, just a package, an intro package. And we're really looking forward to having some funding opportunities, some research opportunities, and just continuing to develop this field in Canada.
Absolutely. That's really great news. And I know, Camille, that that is not the only animal justice news. We've been waiting to break this big bombshell for a while, but this is really your baby. So I'm going to let you dig the big news. It's like, brrr, we need like a drum roll.
Drum roll. believe it or not, it's 2018, and that means it's our 10-year anniversary. I can't believe that.
I can't believe it either. 10 years. Where has the time gone?
Yeah, I feel old.
I feel like just yesterday I was holding the newborn Animal Justice in my arms and saying, oh, it's so cute and cuddly. And look at that. It's suddenly 10 years old and off we go.
It's all grown up. So to celebrate this momentous anniversary, we are having a gala, an anniversary gala on June 8th in Toronto. And tickets will be on sale soon. We'll have a gala website out where you can learn all the details. But it's this gorgeous venue called The Burrows on Queen West in Toronto. And we're aiming just to have a really special evening with a video celebrating all that we've accomplished together in the last 10 years, some special guests, an amazing vegan meal catered likely by a Toronto top chef, and some really cool silent auction packages as well.
It's going to be fantastic. I have already booked my ticket to come in for that special event. And Camille, I know that that weekend is obviously going to be a crazy runaround for all of us involved with Animal Justice, but I just can't see us letting an opportunity for a live Paw & Order podcast to somehow play a part in that festivity.
I think we're going to have to make it happen, considering it's only every few months that we're in the same place, Peter.
Yeah, we're going to have to make Paw & Order happen. And obviously, it's sort of a Paw & Order special Animal Justice 10-year anniversary gala. So yeah, very exciting. I think it's really it's exciting on every level. I don't want to talk too much about the 10 years of Animal Justice because I think that's going to be the subject of that June Paw & Order podcast. But I think the gala is a great opportunity for us to celebrate some of the things we've done, look forward to the future, and bring all of our supporters together for a special evening. So I hope to see a lot of Paw & Order listeners at this gala.
We can't wait.
But that's not all, Camille. I know you've been busy. I heard you the other day on CBC Radio, and it was some really great stuff about zoos. You were a big host of, a special guest on Cross Country Checkup. Why don't you tell us a little bit about it?
Yeah, that's right. So Cross Country Checkup, I grew up listening to this show, so it's always had a special place in my heart. But it's the 4 to 6 p.m. Eastern Time call-in show live across the country on CBC Radio. And this week, they really wanted to talk about the ethics of keeping animals in zoos and aquariums, which, Peter, is just astounding to me that, you know, we've gotten to the point where our national broadcaster devotes 2 hours to this discussion on live radio. And I joined to talk about my perspective. I talked about how Canada has the worst animal cruelty laws in the Western world and how animals in zoos are subject to almost no regulation or oversight. And I don't know if you heard any of the callers, Peter, but they largely agreed with us. They were very supportive of this idea that we shouldn't be confining animals in zoos or aquariums anymore.
Yeah, the whole we're obviously going to do a special on zoos at some point. It just seems inevitable that we're going to talk about it in more depth. But there's no question that there is a tide turning with respect to zoos and the exhibition of exotic animals for profit. And it is a real concern to all of us in Animal Justice. And it's something that the law has not grappled with sufficiently, in my view.
No. But more to come on this for sure. It's a huge area of litigation and legislation.
Yeah, we're going to be talking about it. Yeah.
So, Peter, I think that you have a bit of news as well. What have you been up to?
Yes, we are having it's a big day. This is not an animal law thing. There's been a lot going on for me. This is a very busy time, and I think I've talked before. I'm teaching animals in the law right now, so I'm doing these wonderful sessions on animal law, and it's just been a wonderful run of guest speakers in my class. We've had yesterday we had Professor Katie Sykes talking about international law governing animals. We had Animal Justice's own Anna Pippas talking about farm animals. It's really been a great run. So I'll talk about that in a minute, but I'm also really busy with my practice. I am a part-time defense counsel doing appellate work. And as it turns out, I found out last week that I am going back to the Supreme Court of Canada for another run, this time not on an animal case. It's a very famous criminal law case out of Alberta called the Barton case. And I'm pretty excited personally. It's always a thrill, although a lot of work, to go back to the Supreme Court of Canada.
Well, congratulations on that. I'm excited for you. And I also understand that this is like your third Supreme Court case in 3 years.
I get busy. I don't like to fool around. I was called back to the bar in 2015. And yeah, this is my third time in less than 3 years. So I'm pretty excited. I've been really lucky. I've got some cool cases, including some animal law cases. And who knows, Camille, maybe some more good animal law cases in our future. But yeah, going to the Supreme Court is always a lot of fun. And I want to talk a little bit more about some of the stuff. I wanted to let you in, Camille, on some of the stuff we've been doing in my class, because one of the things I do in my animal law class, there's obviously a lot of substantive law, and we talk about where the law fails animals. But I have long been a believer that the best way for students to learn about the law is for them to really experience it. And what I mean by experiencing it is that I give them the opportunity for one of their assignments to do what's called a creative commentary. And in this creative commentary, they essentially have the ability to do anything they want to interact with any case or any reading or any material that we've had in the entire course. And through that interaction, they express themselves artistically so that they comment in some way on the case, and then they express it through a poem or a picture or a song or whatever. And I can tell you, the results are really fantastic, Camille. You let these students go in creative directions, it's amazing what they can do.
That's so interesting, and like such a novel way to me of teaching animal law. Like, I don't think I've ever experienced any law class whatsoever in school where you had that kind of creative option. So I'm sure the students enjoy it.
I think they really have. And I think they're a little daunted at first, but once they start using their creative muscles, I have never been disappointed. This is the third time that I've done it. And I have not once been disappointed by the amazing results that the students come up with. And I wanted to share a few of them with our listeners, because I think they're very moving. And I've got two of them here for us today that we're going to listen to. I think they're wonderful ways of really bringing another dimension to some of the problems with animal law. It's not just that they're good artistic pieces of work. I really think they bring a great deal of insight to the problems faced by animals. So I want to share two of them quickly with our listeners, because I'll think you'll enjoy them. And the first of these is from a couple of years ago. It's not from this year. And just by the way, let me say, there are so many good ones that I have. I'd love to share some of the others, but they're visual. They don't actually work over the podcast, but these two do. And the first of these is a song, and it's by Stefan Katona from a couple of years back. He's a songwriter, and he decided to write a song about what, from my mind, is the most famous case in Canadian history. You know the decision I'm talking about, don't you, Camille, that defines our cruelty laws?
Oh, yeah. You must be talking about Menard.
It is indeed the Menard decision. And this particular commentary essentially comments on the structure of the Menard decision and puts it together and explains why it's such a difficult test to use in terms of protecting animals. So why don't we give a listen? We're not going to listen to the whole thing because it's a bit long, but let's give a listen to a couple of minutes of this song, which is by Stefan Katona, and it is about the Menard case.
As the crown of creation, I am humane. I avoid inflicting unnecessary pain. But if you compromise my financial gain, the letter of the law is clear and plain. In case you can't read, let me translate. Cattle's our chattels and a horse's hay. Cattle are chattels and a horse's hay.
So long as all the purpose for a legitimate purpose is scot-free, whereas the interest of the beast don't interest me, I will protect the interest of the industry
with a purpose sought and a means employed. I purchase my license to exploit. All conviction I avoid. It's more likely I'll get hit by an asteroid. So in case you don't know it, at the end of the show, a chicken is a chattel and a sow is dough. chicken is a chattel and a sow is dumb.
I gotta be honest, I get a little chill every time I hear it. I really love that song. I think that some of the lyrics are incredibly insightful. What did you think about it, Camille?
Yeah, it's super fascinating. I mean, how often do you hear the words unnecessary suffering in a musical performance? it combines music and law beautifully.
Yeah, I love, I mean, to me, the line, what really brings it home, I love the chorus, right? So it's like, for those of you who couldn't decipher every word, it's so long as all of the hurt is for a legitimate purpose, you're scot-free. And if that doesn't sum up animal cruelty law, I don't know what does, because frankly, we will protect the interests of the industry. Right. That's the basis of what the student is getting at. And the interests of the beast don't interest me. And it is a really fascinating insight. And I think an incredibly creative way to put forward really the core test of animal cruelty law.
Yeah. And, you know, Peter, I'm sure we'll do an episode on this stuff at some point because it's so it's, you know, it just totally messes with your mind to think of how our cruelty laws are conceived and operationalized. And the song gets to the heart of the issue is that if you're inflicting suffering on an animal for a so-called legitimate or reasonable purpose, then it's okay.
So I want to share this second one. Now, Camille, you had heard that song before because I played it for you a couple of years ago. But this one is brand new. It's from this year's class. It's by a student named Rowan Hickey. And she has done a wonderful piece of poetry. It's actually a spoken word poetry. And she is commenting on another of the most famous or infamous, I guess, cases. Do you remember the Mulbach decision from Alberta, Camille?
Oh, I sure do. That was a doozy of a case. I believe, Peter, correct me if I'm wrong, it was a massive neglect case where the defendant was acquitted.
Yeah, it is a massive farm neglect case. One of the reasons why prosecutors are so reluctant to charge farms these days, because Mr. Mulbach had essentially, when the SPCA got there, was a house of horrors, as usual. A lot of cows down, a lot of cows injured, and et cetera. And Mr. Mulbach, as you'll hear in this spoken word, was acquitted. And they'll talk a little bit about why. But again, what I think is really insightful is the way the student presents it and some of the emotions that come through in the spoken word. I'll let that speak for itself. I will just point out that this is an edited version. Again, the original spoken word is a little bit long, so I've cut out one part of it, but you'll get a good sense of what this is about, Camille. So let me play that for you now.
Due diligence, part one, investigation. I stand at the edge of the farm and I listen to the wind. The May air is still. A pin could drop and you would hear the echo. Unraveling in the hot air, cries of calves and sows and bulls. Help me. Water. Help us. You could hear them echo. The ground that had once been mud dried into twisted, heaving mounds, cradling the skeletons of our failures, the ones we were too late to save. Calves pick their way over the cracked bones, their eyes bleary between pink, pus-filled lids. I meet their gaze. They can't see me. Photograph everything. We'll need the evidence. I hide my eye behind the lens, hoping to blind myself from what I see. A steer stands tethered in a stall. But why? He couldn't move if he was in an open field. No fence, no farmer in sight. His scrotum so swollen, his hind legs droop from the weight. His eyes meet mine. Help me. Click. A wind kicks up and dust tumbles across my lips. They rub together like matchsticks. Water. Two pens have none, one pen had some, but none that one would drink. Tadpoles wriggle in the murky depths, algae blooming into a garden. Click. My footsteps prick her ears. Her eyes roll back to find me, but she does not rise. Her neck tense, ribs straining against her skin, dancing like accordion keys as she breathes. She can't get up, and she hasn't in a long time. Help us. Click. Boots round the corner. I put down my lens. I want to see the man who did this. His face is not unusual. recognizable a face of 1,000 men. But his eyes crinkle at the corners, his shoulders shrug. I did my best. Part 2. Trial. 2 years since the photographs were developed. 2 years since the skeletal steers called for help. 2 years of calves growing and dying, their skeletons mixing into the dust, placed on the back burner until we reach trial. 2 years more of suffering, distress, and death. 2 years, but now they will finally have justice. The Animal Protection Act, Section 2, Sub 1, governs the proceedings, where no person shall cause or permit an animal of which the person is the owner or the person in charge to be or to continue to be in distress. Guilty. He must be. A strict liability offense, the Crown proved it. Beyond a reasonable doubt, no mens rea required. He was the owner, the one responsible, and they were in distress. Guilty. However, the word no prosecution wants to hear. The defense was made that he did what he could. Due diligence, the court called it, in accordance with reasonable and generally accepted practices. But was it? Really? Reasonable? Standard cattle care practices, a standard of cruelty masked by years of tradition, generations of nonchalance in the face of death, disease, and drought. Reasonable? Maybe. Maybe not. But for Mulbach, it was a balance. The probability that he did his due diligence, that he did his best, outweighing the mountain of evidence we had of the animal's distress. Acquittal. Part 4. Reflection. Seventh page news. Nothing special. Nothing out of the ordinary. He is not an owner of a puppy mill, a man who beats his horse. He is just a man. A man who did his best, with cattle suffering as a consequence. His eyes crinkle in the photograph, a smile stretched across his face. He did his best. Click. The decision is released. I read it. Again and again and again. If you read between the lines, one message rings clear. We in this country, with our legislation and protections, don't care about animals. How could we care when the practices that we know cause pain, distress, and death are standard? If a farmer can say, I did my best, as his cows lay dying, thirsty, and diseased, how can we say the system works when he is vindicated simply by a chorus of his colleagues? Echoing his words back to the court, he did his best, he did what I would do, it's what we all do. A herd mentality of dismissing the distress, distress that we see or choose not to see, in photographs, in person, in court. How can offenders be punished when the distress they cause form the building blocks of our economy? If we topple them, question these practices, where will that leave us? So the cows still blink, bleary-eyed between pus-filled lids, dry tongues searching the air for rain, for water. Their hind legs quake beneath the weight of diseased limbs. They wither away, their skeletons drawing a map of our system's loopholes, our system's failures. Where our best, our due diligence, is to do nothing, to turn a blind eye.
Wow, Peter, that was something else. I'm almost speechless, and that doesn't usually happen. That was really affecting, especially the first part I found where she described what a cruelty officer would have seen if they investigated that farm. That it actually reminded me of my own experiences photographing the commercial seal hunt and the helplessness that you feel when you witness suffering animals and don't always have a way to do something about it.
It was incredibly moving. I have done a lot of these, and I was as moved listening to the spoken word as I've been to any. I mean, some of the, leaving aside the detail, like some of the imagery, the skeletal bones matching the technical loopholes of the law at the end is just an incredibly powerful image. And some of the insight into the way in which due diligence operates to excuse farm owners and just entrench this culture of you did your best and this is part of the standard economic terrain that we live in is very, very powerful in my view.
Yeah, that's really impressive. Congrats to Rowan.
Yeah, thanks a lot, Rowan, for letting us use that. We asked her beforehand, and she graciously came in and recorded a new version of this. So thanks a lot to Rowan. Now, that just takes us to some of the other things we have to discuss this week, Camille. There have been three prominent animal law cases that we need to talk about, and two of them follow up on our massive discussion from last week involving whales. Yes, we have updates. Camille, why don't you tell us about the whale cases that have been updated since last week?
I know, I can't believe there's more news on whales so soon, but there's two updates in two separate Vancouver Aquarium court cases. The first one is the case we talked about where the park board banned the aquarium from having whales and dolphins, and then the aquarium challenged it and they won. So the park board said, no, you can't impose this ban because the aquarium has a contract with you and it says you can't interfere in their operations. So that happened. We were all pretty disappointed about it, but luckily the park board decides that it's going to appeal that decision. So it's going up now. They're going to seek leave. Animal Justice intervened in it previously. It's unlikely that we will be able to intervene this time because the issues on appeal have been pretty narrowed. It's really just about this contract, and it's not really about the free expression claim that we discussed last episode. So that's number one, Peter.
Right. Yeah. What about the second one involving, I believe, the filmmaker case that we talked about?
That's right. So you'll recall that the aquarium sued Vancouver Aquarium Uncovered filmmaker Gary Charbonneau in a copyright lawsuit to try to take his documentary off the internet. And that went up to the BC Court of Appeal, too. They rejected an injunction that a lower court had imposed, which was great for animals. And we were worried about this because this case could have shut down the free speech of animal advocates. So even though that injunction was kicked out at the Court of Appeal stage, the underlying case was still active. And lawyers for Mr. Charbonneau were set to examine John Nightingale, the CEO of the aquarium, this week, actually. So last week, surprise, surprise, funny timing, their lawyers get a discontinuance notice that says they're dropping that case right before he was set to be discovered and have some tough questions asked of him.
Wow, that's always disappointing. Discovery can be a fun time when you finally, it's very rare that we actually get these cases where you can pin down someone in a position of power and really get into these questions.
Yeah, so a bit of a disappointment, but also a good thing because the case is done and the aquarium film can now be aired without any threat of it being taken down.
Okay, well, that is two very important aquarium cases. They are not the only big case in the news this week. I can tell you that our good friends at Voices for Animal Humane Society and ZooCheck Canada have been bringing the Lucy case back into the news.
That's right. And a lot of you know who Lucy the elephant is already, but she's the solitary lone elephant kept in Edmonton, Peter, your hometown, where she's kept all by herself away from other elephants in the snow for much of the year.
Yeah, and we are already planning to do a full podcast with a main topic on the Lucy the Elephant case, because some of you will be aware that the 2010 decision of the Alberta Court of Appeal is one of the most famous animal law cases ever decided, and that is called Reese versus Edmonton Zoo, and it's a very famous case because it gets into a lot of principles about how advocates for animals can advance causes of action, and we will talk about that in greater depth, but just to give you quickly, the answer is a bunch of advocates, including Tove Reese, who's involved in this decision as well, tried to force the Edmonton Zoo to turn Lucy over to a sanctuary, essentially, by using a variety of legal mechanisms, and they failed to do so. The court in 2010 said that they do not have standing to advance this cause. So fast forward to today, the folks at ZooCheck and Voice for Animals Humane Society decided to take a different tactic. And what they tried to do was to challenge the Edmonton government's decision to issue a zoo permit to the Edmonton Zoo.
That's right. And the reason that they're challenging this decision is that they're saying the zoo hasn't complied with all of the government's conditions for issuing a permit. And the basis for this is health claims around Lucy. She's got serious foot problems. She's got serious breathing problems and is not generally considered a healthy animal. She's kept, obviously, in a very cold climate where she lacks the kind of space that elephants would have in the wild. So there's all these things they point to in the statute that they're saying, look, the zoo isn't even complying with these legal requirements, so they shouldn't be allowed to have this permit.
Right. And the real difficulty, as it is for animal advocates in all cases, is how do we challenge that decision? How do you find some legal method of challenging? And that's really what is at issue at this case that's being brought before the courts again. And I can tell you that in December, this case went before the Alberta Court of Queen's Bench, which is the lower court, the trial court in Alberta. And once again, ZooCheck, Voices for Animals, etc., they lost the case. The judge summarily dismissed the case in a very tidy 3 pages, simply saying you don't have the right to bring this action. The zoo permit has nothing to do with Lucy's health, and therefore you have chosen the wrong procedural avenue. Now, the reason I'm raising this today is last week, the ZooCheck folks went back to the Alberta Court of Appeal in an attempt to appeal this decision.
Yeah, and you managed to actually sit in for a little bit of that hearing, I think, Drew.
I did. Unfortunately, I had another commitment and the hearing got delayed because another very, very dull and boring family law case, which in my opinion had absolutely no merit, but for what it's worth, because I had to sit through the entire family law decision. In any event, so they went through the entire family law decision. It just kept getting delayed, delayed, delayed. And eventually, unfortunately, I had another commitment in the afternoon. So I did not get to see the whole hearing. But I have read the factum for the case, and I've been told that the hearing went very well, that the Alberta Court of Appeal was engaged, and that we can hope that they will engage with these issues seriously. But in effect, just to tell you what went on, the case for ZooCheck is a fascinating one. And they're essentially, what they're arguing is the case that all advocates argue. We have no legal way to bring this forward. And what we are looking for is a legal way to bring this forward. And essentially, the other side keeps saying, well, you're bringing the wrong place. You're bringing it in the wrong place. You're bringing it in the wrong place. We don't have the jurisdiction, which is the legal way of saying you shouldn't be here to answer this claim. And as a result, no one ever gets to the point of discussing whether Lucy should be in the zoo. And that's what is so frustrating to the applicants in this case.
Yeah, after all of this legal wrangling, all these decisions, all these applications, no court has ever engaged with the substantive issues about Lucy's health, about the conditions that she's kept in, and whether the zoo should be continued to permit her to have Lucy. So I think you said this, Peter, this is your line, but the frustration that ZooCheck and the animal advocacy groups are experiencing really shines through in their factum that they filed in this Court of Appeal case. They're saying, just tell us what's the appropriate way. We want to bring this case forward. It's a legitimate one. It should be adjudicated, but we need a way to do it.
And I think the factum is really fantastic. I've got to tell you that it is essentially just a long pleading, essentially saying, look, you cannot let procedure drive the substantive remedy. And the procedure being, well, we can't challenge it this way and we can't challenge it this way. And why should you have to send back these poor activist groups over and over again? If Lucy is not being treated properly, there has to be a way of accessing the courts. And what's so irritating, Camille, and I can see the frustration of the groups in this, the courts seem to acknowledge this. They seem to say, well, there is some way of doing this, but then every time the groups try to bring a case forward, the courts shut them down and say, well, you're in the wrong place.
Yeah, and you know, Peter, this whole proceeding sort of reminds me of the reasons that a lot of people just don't like lawyers. It's that they think they put up delay and procedure and blocking tactics at every step of the way rather than get to the real issues. And I kind of feel that when you look at the whole litigation here.
Goddamn lawyers. I hate... No, wait a minute. There's a paradox.
Except the
here.
Animal lawyers. We're nice.
Oh, yeah. We're the good ones. I hate nasty lawyers. No, it is really a frustrating case. And I think all of us in the animal law community owe a real debt to ZooCheck, Voice for Animals, Humane Society, Tove Reese, and the lawyers in this case, who I believe are doing it pro bono or at a strongly reduced rate, because I think they're advancing a problem that we face in every single corner of the system. And what's so irritating about this is that every time ZooCheck and the other groups go forward, they get hit with cost sanctions. Every single time the courts impose cost sanctions and they have to start paying the opposition. Can you imagine? This just drives, I know it drives Tove and the others crazy, that they're paying out $4,000 to $6,000 every time they lose to the Edmonton Zoo.
Yeah, no, it drives me insane too that they would get hit with a cost sanction for something that's at the heart of what it means to be acting in the public interest. They're literally acting for an animal who can't take these proceedings herself. Her situation is a real matter of public concern. She's kept in conditions that are allegedly quite devastating to her and to her health, both mental and physical. And yet they get hit with cost sanctions every time they lose on a silly procedural ground.
Seriously, it is really the thing that drives me the most crazy. I wrote about it when Reese versus Edmonton Zoo went to the Supreme Court, that the Supreme Court imposed costs against the advocates. I could not believe it. It was, to me, the most galling thing, because the Supreme Court has an absolute discretionary authority to impose a cost sanction. They don't have to do it. And if you compare this case to the next case that we're going to discuss, and I don't want to get into that right now because we're going to talk about it in just a moment, what's probably my favorite part of the next case is that all the judges, even though there was disagreement about the remedy to give involving the custody of this dog that we're going to discuss, they all agreed that costs should not be awarded because essentially it was a public interest matter that needed to be litigated.
Yeah. And, you know, just the idea that you would penalize somebody for trying to take action on behalf of an animal where that animal's in a very vulnerable position and doesn't have the ability to do so themselves, I think really puts a damper on the ability of animal advocates and other individuals to bring cases affecting animals, and it hampers our ability to develop the case law in this field.
Absolutely. Well, we're going to talk much more about Reese versus Edmonton Zoo in a future podcast, so we'll probably leave it right there for now, Camille. But really interesting case. We will be monitoring it closely, and we will keep you posted on any updates.
Will do. Okay, so I guess we're now transitioning into the main topic for the day, which is a case that just came out last week, hot off the presses, called Baker and Hermina from the Newfoundland Court of Appeal. And it's a case about dog custody.
Wow, it is a case about dog custody. It just came off the presses March 6, 2018. I want to give a shout out to my good friend, Nicole O'Byrne from the University of New Brunswick, who brought this to my attention. And we just decided, Camille, we could not let this go by. There are not that many animal law cases that have gone up to appellate courts in this country. What is it, more than five? I don't think it's more than five. I think we're talking, it's certainly not more than 10.
No, certainly not more than 10. And if it was five, that would be surprising to me. And while we're giving shout-outs, I'll give a shout-out to Jody Lazar at the Dalhousie School of Law, who gave me this case last night and did some interviews on it as well. So it's clearly making big waves in the legal community. And, you know, as you mentioned, Peter, one of these reasons is that it's so rare for any appellate court to consider an animal case. And this one has some interesting legal issues. So the heart of the case is pet custody. And what we've got is a couple. They were a former couple at this point from Newfoundland. They adopted a dog, and there's some dispute over who adopted the dog and then who ended up owning the dog by the time they split up.
Yeah, absolutely. And there's some questions about doing this, but it seems fairly clear. A factual finding of the trial court is that Mr. Baker, he's not the husband because, of course, I don't think they're married. So the male spouse in the partnership, Mr. Baker, paid for the dog. Is that correct, Camille?
It seems like he paid for the dog. The dog was apparently purchased from a breeder in Ontario and then shipped to Newfoundland. But then the dog was picked up by the female partner, Ms. Hermina. She picked up the dog. There's some evidence that she may have contributed to a down payment on the dog as well. So yeah, there's a lot of mixing of monies at the early stages.
Yeah, although I think the fact finding that we're stuck with on appeal is that he did ultimately pay for the dog and always intended to do so. But there's no question that together they care for the dog. He's out in Alberta 14 days out of every 21. So he's home for a week every 3 weeks. And essentially she's taking care of the dog full time. And this goes on for a couple of years. And eventually, it doesn't work out. So they start to split out. And let's just say it looks like it's an acrimonious breakup. They take out peace bonds against each other, which are essentially restraining orders. And the basic idea is she keeps the dog. And he doesn't like it, so he sues her in small claims court.
Yeah, and he claims ownership over the dog. He produces receipts and evidence that he was the one who purchased the dog and just owned the dog all along. And her claim is more along the lines of, well, look, I cared for this animal. You know, I clearly have a strong bond and connection with this dog. He was away for much of the time. I took care of veterinary bills and feeding costs and other monies paid associated with the dog. And that's kind of what the courts were left with in terms of evidence when they were trying to figure this out. So as you mentioned, Peter, the first level of court was a small claims court, and he initially won at that stage. So the court said, yeah, you know, the dog is owned by him. You know, look at this. He's got receipts. He's got the title claim because he purchased the dog.
And as the court says in the appellate decision, the small claim judge's approach reflects the traditional theory that property only changes hands through deliberate transactions, including gifts or purchases. So essentially, this is a very traditional approach to property. He bought the dog. Once he could prove that he bought the dog, that was it. There is no shift in the ownership of the dog.
Yeah, door closed. Pretty simple, straightforward. But interestingly, it gets appealed to the Supreme Court Trial Division of Newfoundland, and the judge there was trying to be a little bit more creative, and I think really saw a situation where maybe there's shifting conceptions of property ownership, depending on how that property is used throughout a relationship. And the judge in that case ended up ordering a joint custody arrangement with a schedule for sharing the dog.
And I think most importantly, what I think is so important in these cases involving animals, and we'll get into the dissenting judgment in the Court of Appeal in just a moment, but essentially that decision is following the decision of the Supreme Court trial division judge, who essentially says, well, wait a minute, even if we might apply this traditional property model to, say, a toaster or a chair, animals are not toasters and chairs. So maybe we should modify the traditional theory of ownership when it warrants it, because of the nature of the interests of the parties and, to some extent, the animals in the case.
Yeah, and this really gets to the heart of what confuses people about pet custody cases, which is exactly that. We just don't think of animals like divisible property, like tables or chairs or vehicles that you might split up when a couple is no longer together. They mean so much more to us. And I would say for most people, Peter, they're really more like children than like your kitchen table.
Wait, and that seems obvious to the layperson. I think it seems obvious to lots of the people listening to this podcast, but the truth of the matter is it has not seemed obvious to the courts. And the courts have been very deliberate here. And what this is an area of animal law that has filled me with a particular sense of rage. And let me just stress, I don't think this is the most important animal law issue on the table. I don't think fighting for the interests of rich pet owners is really going to make or break animal law for any of us. But nonetheless, it drives me crazy the way courts have tried to dismiss this issue and essentially using the idea that animals are unimportant. We have case after case, probably the most notorious and in my mind the most disgusting is a case out of Saskatchewan called Henderson and Henderson, where the Court of Queen's Bench said, don't bring these cases to us. They're just not important. The court should not be dealing with animal custody, period. And frankly, I just think that's a disgusting case. And I think that's what's dripping through some of the decisions that are going on even today. And the appellate court, we'll talk about the majority decision in just a moment, it's probably not quite as bad as those cases, but I think it also endorses this idea that these are not valuable, animals don't matter enough to require consideration of legal interest.
I really hate that too, Peter. And the courts always say, well, we just have so many more important things to spend our time on. Like the reality is, in many cases, people go to court for extremely frivolous reasons, especially in the context of family law, fighting over like literally nickels and dimes, and the courts are obligated to take on those cases. Pets are very important to people. We prioritize our companion animals. Maybe the court doesn't feel like that's important, but you know, if you're a litigant in such a case, it definitely is important to you. So for them just to bow out and say, not really our problem, I think just abdicates, you know, the purpose of why we have this court system and rule of law in the first place.
Yeah, and absolutely. And the majority decision takes a lot of these points pretty much straightforward. And just to highlight a few, the majority decision is written by Justice White of the Newfoundland and Labrador Court of Appeal, and essentially says, in the eyes of the law, a dog is an item of personal property, and therefore the only question is who owns it. So it's a pretty straightforward approach to law. And the judge says that this case seems to pit traditional legal doctrine against social realities. And what the court ultimately decides is we shouldn't do any consideration of new ways of looking at the particular aspect of law. And I just want to read one aspect of this case. It's a paragraph 18 of the court's decision, and here's what it says. The appeal judge, which was the summary conviction appeal judge who created that new form of custody order, her approach significantly loosens the traditional requirement that a party who claims joint ownership should point to a particular transaction where ownership changed hands. Here's the interesting part. The court should be open to modifying legal doctrines to reflect social realities, but it should not do so without considering the practical implications of the change. And then goes on to say, well, we shouldn't do this because the legal system is not well equipped to deal with the problems raised by joint ownership of dogs. I mean, it's just a lot of absolute nonsense. What they're really saying is we don't want to deal with the problems of joint ownership of dogs. The idea that the courts can't do it is just absolute and utter nonsense. It's not as if they don't develop these sorts of orders for kids. They know how to do it. And yes, the court points out that they're going to be unsatisfying results. Again, why is that different from kids?
There's no difference whatsoever in my mind. You know, that they keep saying we should consider the practical implications of this change. Well, yeah, you should. You are the appellate court. It's kind of your job to consider the practical implications of this change. Appellate courts are essentially policy-making courts in a lot of ways, and they both apply the law, but they also consider sort of the political realities and the policy implications of their rulings. So they're so well placed to consider this.
And it's such irritating nonsense that they get into. I'm sorry, Camille, I'm getting a little outraged, but I absolutely hate this. They come up and they say, well, we can't do this because it's going to lead to more conflict and all the parties are going to have conflict and it's going to lead to more headache and wasted time and legal fees. That's what they're actually setting out. But what they don't seem to realize or don't even seem to acknowledge or don't frankly even seem to consider is that when the court comes up at the Court of Appeal and says, we're not going to ever consider these types of orders, there's no need for the parties to ever negotiate these sorts of orders. Like, the basic idea of family law is that you try to negotiate within the framework of the law as it has developed. And a few weeks ago, in episode one of this podcast, we called the state of Illinois a hero because their new laws allow for the consideration of best interests and allow for sole or joint custody. You remember that, Camille? It wasn't that long ago.
No, it wasn't that long ago at all. Illinois, also Alaska now has a system where you can consider the best interests and apply for joint ownership as well. So it's not like this can't be done. It's not like other jurisdictions and courts aren't doing this. It's just an unwillingness on the part of this court in this situation to really engage with those issues.
Yeah. And what I remember from that article involving Illinois, what I thought was the most salient part to this discussion, is that the Illinois legislature said, look, we don't expect dog cases to be flying before the courts, but by putting in this recognition, we give the parties an incentive to negotiate. And the Newfoundland and Labrador Court of Appeal have essentially taken that away. They're essentially saying the only incentive you have is if you love your dog, by all means, make sure you use your own money to pay for it. It's just absolute, utter nonsense.
Yeah, I think you're right that this would likely result in far fewer cases coming before the courts rather than more. There's all kinds of reasons why people don't want to litigate issues, the main one being cost. And if you give them some sort of way to resolve this before they get to court, chances are they're going to take that.
Yeah, and it's just, anyway, I find it very irritating. I find the court's whole attitude very irritating, and I find it unfortunate that they weren't a little bit more open-minded. I should say, Camille, you might have found that just because they didn't want to seem particularly mean, they left open the possibility, I swear to God, this is how ridiculous it is, that, like, you might be able to seek a trust in the dog in an appropriate case. But of course, the small claims court is unable to order a trust because that is what's known as an inherent remedy. And I won't get into that for lawyers, but they may be able to ask a superior court to order it in an appropriate case. Like, again, it's just more nonsense. It's like, we recognize that there might be a case in which this is warranted, but procedurally, we recognize that's going to be incredibly difficult. So let's leave this loophole open. So you have some way to do this, but we'll make it incredibly difficult for you to actually do that. Drives me crazy.
And this whole idea is a claim, potentially an unjust enrichment, which would be part of a sort of a trust thing. But the only entitlement that she would have, they, in their view, would be damages. So she might get some money out of this, but she obviously doesn't care about money if she's litigating this. She cares about having the dog that she loves. So I don't even see that as a useful solution.
Absolutely, Camille. Now, unlike Henderson and Henderson, which is just a disaster case from beginning to end, by the way, we will link to Henderson versus Henderson for your reading displeasure in the show notes. It's a 2016 case, the Saskatchewan Queen's Bench, and we'll, of course, link to this case as well. Unlike Henderson versus Henderson, there was some good news in this decision, despite everything I've said. Camille, you want to fill us in on the good news?
Yeah, I do. So Justice Hoge, I believe it's pronounced, H-O-E-G-G, She wrote a really compelling dissent that actually does engage with some of the difficult issues in this case and tries to chart a path forward. So she talks about how it's complicated to determine the ownership of a property, and sometimes that conception might change over the time in a relationship. And she talks about how some of the money changed hands here and how that might sort of support this claim by Ms. Hermina for a greater stake in ownership. But she goes on to say some really interesting sort of general things about deciding pet ownership. And she says, I'm looking at paragraph 48 here. She says that determining the...
Which will be the paragraph that everybody looks at. This is a good one for all animal law people. You want to highlight that one?
Yeah, definitely one of the leading sort of passages right now on this topic. And I'll just read a bit of it because it's somewhat long. But she says it's hard to decide who owns pets when families break apart, and ownership of a dog is more complicated to decide than, say, a car or a piece of furniture. It is not as though animate property, like a dog, is a divisible asset, but dogs are more than just animate. People form strong emotional relationships with their dogs, and it cannot seriously be argued otherwise. Dogs have traits that are normally associated with people, and she lists a few of those, like personality and intelligence. And this creates a really difficult context where separating family members sometimes require courts to come to their assistance. So it's really encouraging to see that. And I think there's, let me just scroll down on this decision. There's more to it, Peter.
Well, before you do, just let me say like, wow, like amazing.
Just to
right?
acknowledge.
Like the idea, the idea that a dog is not the same as a car. Wow, which was apparently a leap too far for the majority decision, the Saskatchewan Court of Queen's Bench, and other courts who have just said, nope, it's a piece of property, treat it like property, that's the end of the day. Like, I mean, it's unbelievable how essentially what we have to do with these courts is essentially convince them to make insights that seem obvious to everyone around you. Like the idea that a dog
is
not
so common sense. And she has a line at the end of paragraph 49 as well that I just love. She says, people acquire personal property all the time, usually solely but sometimes jointly with others, and in doing so pay little attention to the legal rules respecting exactly who is acquiring title to the property. And Peter, that just rings so true. When you adopt a dog together, people don't think of that dog as property and get concerned about the title. They think of the dog as a family member who's being adopted into the family.
Absolutely. And I think, again, it's just sort of an open-minded look at the way in which we consider property. These are all common law rules anyway. It is not as if these things are crafted in stone by the legislature. This is essentially one judge of the Court of Appeal who says, you know what, this is worthwhile. And I think that's really at the core of the rest of the decision. I mean, the judge goes on at paragraph 52 to say it's a much more complex. I like this as well, Camille. The ownership of a dog is a more complex and nuanced question than the ownership of, again, say, a bicycle.
And
looks at all the factors. Where two people contest the ownership of an animal, let's look at who purchased and raised it, who exercised care and control, who bore the burden of care and comfort. I mean, my God, it's so common sense. It's like, let's look at everything around this property, and essentially it boils down to recognizing that this is a piece of property that should not be treated in the same way as any other piece of property. Animate property, that's essentially what it is.
Yeah, different categories of property for different purposes. And, you know, it's interesting, she doesn't move us out of this property paradigm. She's not really talking about all these, you know, stages you can consider in the context of the animal's best interests, which is another way that you could start to look at these cases as well. Who's going to take better care of the animal, and who's in terms of the animal, is it in their best interest to go with partner A or partner B? That's another way you could look at it. So she's not really moving out of that paradigm that they're considered property, but she is providing a fairly, you know, useful laundry list of things that you should consider when you're deciding whose property the animal is.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's a very powerful thing. But to be honest, to me, the most important part of the decision is paragraph 59. And it is really her concluding remarks that essentially, I don't know, it's... Is it the judicial version of in your face? I think that's probably a bit harsh, but it's sort of like, no, you didn't. Like, you know, it's that sort of thing. Because essentially the majority reasons are dripping with, we shouldn't engage in these decisions at all. Animals are not worth it. And Camille, what does she fire back at the majority position?
Well, she says some just brilliant things. She says, I must say something more, her concluding paragraph.
Oh, please read it, Camille. Please read it. Get in there. Get some emotion in there, Camille.
She, Peter, is disturbed by the notion that courts should not spend their precious time and resources determining the ownership of dogs. Litigation over the ownership and possession of dogs is far from unknown to the courts. which is an indicator that the ownership and possession of dogs is very meaningful to people. Like, yeah, so obvious. And she says,
I mean, drop the mic, right?
Yeah, drop the mic. And she says she emphasizes the emotional bonds between people and their dogs, and that fair decision respecting ownership and possession can be much more important to litigants and to society than decisions respecting the ownership of a piece of furniture or a few dollars. Like, yeah, hell yeah. And she also goes on to say that civil and family courts routinely engage in cases of which the spoils are a whole lot less than the family dog, which is absolutely true. You can find a court case over a, you know, a $5, you know, whatever, a bag of chips if you want to. Like, you could do that. And that as a society, we accept without questions that our courts exist to resolve disputes that parties cannot resolve themselves. That is a hallmark of a just society and a justice system where the rule of law governs.
Beautiful. And she,
beautiful. It's amazing.
Yeah, it's absolutely beautiful.
Yeah, and she concludes by saying, you know, don't misinterpret her remarks to mean that she's advocating or encouraging people to litigate ownership and possession of dogs, but that there's no principal reason why people in a dispute over a dog cannot avail themselves of the courts for help.
Absolutely fantastic. And it just, it's the only thing that gives me some solace, because as you can tell, my blood starts to boil over that decision of the majority. I really feel that it's a frustrating decision. Keep your animal disputes out of these courts at all time. And that is not the way we should go about changing and thinking about the legal paradigm under which animals live. And all it takes is one judge. And frankly, I think this judgment, it's not quite as far reaching as Justice Fraser's decision in Reese versus Edmonton Zoo, which we'll talk about in weeks to come, which is really a much more broad decision talking about standing and about the need to litigate animal issues before the courts. But I think this decision by Justice Hogue is almost as important. It really is essentially asking people to make the common sense understanding that animals are not cars and we need to look at their interests differently when we're resolving disputes about them.
Yeah, and I think you're right, Peter. And I think that her dissent lays the groundwork potentially for something better to evolve under the common law, which I think we're seeing is really important. You know, these cases keep coming up. The Henderson case in Saskatchewan, there's tons of other ones. And people are really struggling over this issue of pet custody. So I would love to see our legislators address this and start enacting laws that provide guidance to judges. But in the meantime, while these disputes are going on, they can't just bury their heads under the sand and ignore the importance of them. They need to act. And I do hope that she's laid a bit of the groundwork for doing so.
Let's just hope that next time we're looking at this 2-1 decision going the other way, because as much as I like that decision, it is just frustrating to lose these cases time after time.
It is. And, you know, it's in animal law, I usually tend to say that we lose more than we win, but I hope that's going to start shifting soon, because it's cases like this that really show the need for it.
Heroes and Zeros.
All right, we are back, and it is time for everybody's favorite segment. I don't know if it's anybody's favorite segment. I'm going to say that every week.
You always say that, Peter.
Everybody's favorite segment, Heroes and Zeros. And Camille, today you were going to lead us off with a hero. Continuing our theme, we're going with Eastern Canada. We got a hero out from the East today. Camille, tell us about her.
We do. Andrea McAnany. I hope I'm saying that right, Andrea, but she lives in New Brunswick, and she started a petition on change.org calling for a ban on keeping live lobsters in tanks at grocery stores. And she's specifically directing this at Sobeys, but it happens in a ton of places. And if you've ever walked into one of those stores, my heart breaks every time I see this, but there's lobsters stacked just on top of each other. Their claws are banded together. They're obviously in very small spaces, very, very many creatures jammed in there, much more than in the wild. And Andrea sees this and doesn't think it's okay. So she's doing something about it. She started a petition. She's asking for a ban. And I just love this. It's not really a legal story, but I think it's important for activists, for citizens to take action when they see something like this that they don't agree with. And we know so much more now, Peter, about lobsters and their capacity to feel pain and their capacity to suffer. So I think it's important. People sometimes minimize creatures that don't look very much like us, but they matter too.
And while we recognize that, we should say they don't legally matter, certainly not under the criminal code. I haven't read the New Brunswick animal protection law in that jurisdiction, but I mean, the criminal code protection is restricted to animals, and I'm fairly sure a lobster wouldn't qualify under that definition.
Well, I think it's arguable still. I don't want to close the door off, but there's definitely some challenges there. You always have to look at how animal is defined. You might have a common sense conception of what that means in your head, but the statute might disagree with you. And you're right.
Yeah, I think the fact that it refers to animal or bird is going to exclude lobsters. That's just my basic view, not to mention that in 1999, the reform proposition that was going to expand the definition of animal specifically tried to target this area. So I do think a court would be hard-pressed to go after a lobster case.
Yeah, that may be the case.
We can debate that on a future show, but that's my guess. Anyway, that's our hero of the day.
And Peter, who was our zero this week?
You don't bring me flowers.
Is that Barbara Streisand I hear?
You don't sing me love songs. My mother used to love Barbara Streisand, and I grew up listening to Barbara Streisand songs. So it was like it was a brutal upbringing. It came close to child abuse. I am not a big Barbara Streisand fan. I am less of a Barbara Streisand fan. I'm not going to promise you that's the last time I'm going to sing on the show, but it's not going to be for a while.
So what did poor old Barbara do that gave her the zero award this week?
Barbara brought us some much needed attention to the issue of cloning her dogs. She loved her dog so much that when it died, she decided to go out and clone it. And it brought the issue of cloning into the mainstream society. And there has been a lot of reporting about Barbara and cloning her dogs. And frankly, why should people clone their dogs? They really shouldn't. Camille, fill us in on what's wrong with cloning your dog.
Well, I mean, we kill so many animals in shelters every year because they can't find homes. People just aren't adopting them at sufficient levels. And they're going to breeders, they're cloning their dogs to get new ones. It's really offensive to me that we're not taking better care of the animals that do exist and that we're bringing new ones into society just to fill this emotional need that people have for a bond with an animal who's since deceased. And they think that they can somehow fill that by cloning their animal. And you know, Peter, obviously, genetics don't determine personality to a full extent. They don't determine who an animal is going to turn out being. So I don't even think it works to clone your dog and have an identical animal.
Well, not only that, I mean, it doesn't work. And there's a lot of issues about how often it's actually successful. Everything I've read about cloning, by the way, this is going to be a running theme of our show. It's a line I gave to my students. For all I know, I've already repeated it on this podcast, Camille. But essentially, whenever anybody asks me about an animal practice, my general standard response is this. No matter how bad you think it is, and why you think it's bad, I can just about guarantee you that it's going to be worse. And everything I've read about cloning suggests to me that it's not this innocuous practice while you're just having a dog, like breeding a dog. It's not like that at all. The practice of cloning is very, very unpredictable. The numbers that I'm looking at is about 20 to 30% of the clonings turn out properly, and many of them turn out with hideous deformities. And you're talking about dogs that are being born with genetic malformities that then have to be put down. And in addition, the whole idea of having a clone, well, you can't have a clone. It's not as if the dog is reproducing in a normal way. So you've got to have invasive surgery on the dogs that are going to bear the fetuses to birth. So essentially, you're starting with unnecessary surgery of a dog, multiple clones that are not going to turn out properly because you've got to breed multiple dogs just to try and get one.
Wow.
Isn't that crazy? Like,
that actually is so much worse than I ever could have thought it was. Wow. People, do not clone your dogs, please. Just go to the shelter, adopt a lovely pooch. They're all really nice. They're all looking for homes. You'll be happy.
Good rule of thumb. Anytime you think something's bad, it's generally going to be worse. But yes, Barbara Streisand, you really don't bring me flowers anymore. I'm just because of this, I'm never buying your music again.
I'm sure that's really going to hurt your album sales, but okay.
probably wasn't going to happen anyway. All right, Babs, until next week, that is Heroes and Zeros.
All right. So, Peter, we've got a few questions next for our Q&A segment. And why don't I read out the first one? It's from Emily Benoit. Emily is wondering, how do you personally respond when people in your life who eat meat tell you about how outraged they are about cases like Molly the pig? So we talked about Molly the pig the other week. Molly was a pot-bellied pig. She was adopted from the SPCA in BC, and then her owners killed and ate her, which they were legally entitled to do. So Emily says she's always overwhelmed by the sort of hypocrisy and the head-in-the-sand attitudes of these interactions. And how can She gets some good tips on what to say that might generate discussion or self-reflection, because Emily gets concerned about being labeled like a crazy vegan. And I just love this question, Peter, because I think it's something that we as animal protection advocates and lawyers deal with pretty much every day. Most people in this world are not vegan and care about some animals and don't care about other animals. And, you know, that's something really deeply ingrained in the human psyche, and it can be challenging to interact with. So do you have any tips, Peter, on how you respond to situations like this?
I gotta be honest with you. I take 3 deep breaths and I swallow my first impulse. That's the way I deal with it. As crazy as that sounds, because my impulse is just like Emily's. I just want to say, well, you're being ridiculous. That's every case, right? And I have learned to stop doing that, because I found that a snarky response along those lines is generally not going to be welcomed and generally doesn't advance the discussion. So actually, what I really try and do is swallow that response and actually just engage in the discussion of how ridiculous the case itself actually is, while slowly trying to edge in as many times as I can, you know, trying to nudge the discussion forward into a, yeah, it's kind of interesting, because man, I've learned a lot about pig farming and talking about the pig farming or whatever case it is that you're particularly dealing with. And that's one of the ways I avoid making the crazy vegan comparisons and things like that. But to answer the question, I do not go to the hypocrisy angle. I know it's hypocritical. It is the first thing that jumps to my mind, and I just ignore it. That's the way I deal with it. What about you, Camille?
Well, my approach is somewhat similar. I tend to think that people want to make good decisions. They want to do good things, and that deep down we all care about animals, even if we don't always act in alignment with those beliefs. So I try to emphasize what we agree on first. So I might say to someone, yeah, I agree. It's just so heartbreaking that this poor pig Molly, who was a pet, was then killed and eaten, and really connect with them on that same level, on something that we can find common ground on. And then maybe ask a question, say, you know, it also hurts me really deeply that we do this to, I forget what the number is, but it's somewhere north of 20 million pigs every year in Canada that they are eaten for food and raised in conditions that are much worse than Molly. And I try to ask people, maybe, do you think that there's a difference between Molly and the pig on a commercial farm? And in the case of Molly in particular, I might even point to an example like Esther the Wonder Pig. If you don't already follow Esther, go follow her on Facebook and on Instagram right away. But she is a pig who was bred for industrial purposes. She ended up adopted by these two lovely men who thought that she was a mini pig, and she subsequently grew into a full industrial-sized hog who now lives in their home with them and inspired them to start a sanctuary. And getting to know her as an individual, you can see that she really has a personality. So I try sometimes to connect people who might have questions like this with individual animals like Esther that they can connect with one-on-one and start to break down some of those barriers that stop people from seeing animals as individuals and just make us see them as food.
Yeah, you know what my thoughts are about that, Camille?
What's that?
You're a crazy vegan.
Ouch, Peter. Coming from a fellow vegan, that hurts.
That's how you get crazy vegan thrown in your face.
Well, you know, Emily, I thank you so much for that question. I really like it. And if we want to keep the conversation going, please tweet us if you have any other suggestions. How do you respond to people in these situations? And how do you try to inspire more compassion, both in attitudes and actions? I think it's really important for us to all reflect on this.
Absolutely.
So, Peter, our second question from Emily as well is, she's wondering if we can share any advice to law students who are interested in pursuing animal law in the future. So why don't you kick this off, since you're teaching animal law, and I'll answer based on my own experience.
I can tell you that the answer to me is plain. You have to be committed, you have to be driven, and you have to look for your own opportunities. I know many people who have successfully navigated the route from law student to animal law career of some sort, part-time or full-time, and every one of them has the same thing in common. They are driven, they look for opportunities, they make contact with the right people, they offer to help on a volunteer basis, and they drive themselves to make that a realistic part of their life. Every single other one of them, I've seen lots of people who seem well-intentioned, and they just say, well, I'd like to help out from time to time, but they don't really make the effort to do so, and they don't really drive in that direction, or they seem overwhelmed with the possibility of no career, et cetera, and they just fall off, and they never really go anywhere with animal law. Those who make the switch are absolutely positively driven to do so, because you need that if you're going to succeed in this area.
Yeah, I completely agree with all of that. It can't just be a side passion. If you want to succeed in this area, you need real commitment. And I think your point about making connections is probably the one that I would emphasize the most. It's a very, very small field still. There's only maybe 8 to 12 of us that practice full or maybe half time in the field still in Canada. So it's very, very small. You need to know those people. You need to know who's in that space and what they're up to. And not just lawyers. You also need to know people in animal protection organizations, because that's where a lot of the interesting work and cases end up coming from. It's not always just from lawyers. So I would emphasize the importance of just networking. Meet as many people as you possibly can. If you're still in law school, drop a note to groups in your area, offer to volunteer. They're always looking for help with legal related things, so you're going to get uptake on that for sure. And when you're done law school, there's a great chance you're not going to be practicing in this area full-time right away. Almost nobody actually does that. I spent a couple of years in criminal law first. So I found an area that I really liked practicing in. I worked for a great boss who was a vegan himself, James Silver. He actually represented Anita Crines in the pig trial case. So there was an interest in animal law there that we shared. So land yourself at a good place where your firm might let you pursue those interests, and then just seize every opportunity that comes along, get involved with groups, and try to create your own opportunities.
Yeah. And in addition, I can't believe I forgot this. Listen to Paw and Order every week and share it around to everyone you know, because good karma is what really brings you a career in animal law.
Very important. Thank you, Emily, for that question.
Thanks to everybody for sending in questions. We're always eager for more. So if you have any questions, hit us up on Twitter, email at info@animaljustice.ca or any other place where Camille or I are located. And we look forward to taking questions in upcoming episodes. We'd like to thank all our listeners for tuning in. Please, a reminder, you can subscribe to the Paw & Order podcast using iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, or your favorite podcatcher. And please, please leave us a rating and a review, which helps us reach more people.
You can also share the podcast so that others have the opportunity to listen to it. And we always welcome donations to Animal Justice, which makes Paw & Order possible.
You can find me on Twitter at Peter Sankoff, on Facebook at Professor Sankoff, and at my website, petersankoff.com.
And you can find me online on Twitter at Camille Labchuk, same handle on Instagram. And we always enjoy Twitter conversations about the show or any other animal law or political topics. And finally, thank you so much to our producer, Shannon Milling.
See you next time on Paw & Order.